Okay, folks. Since I've been telling you the emails for the last 3 days, I've been trying to get your DCFs back. I have about 65 left, and I hope to get them done by tomorrow. So by tomorrow, all of you should get your DCFs back. So once I'm all done, I'll send an email out saying, if you sent in your DCF, you haven't got it back, then make sure you send it again. But don't get freak out and start sending it to me again right now, because I don't want to have three or four submissions. So take a look at the very long email I sent last night that you did not read. Right? That's actually the template for how to take apart a DCF. It's actually a very useful template, not just for you to take apart your own DCF, but if you're ever asked to look at somebody else's valuation. So take a look at that, because it'll give you a sense of what you need to do. You know, you've heard of the expression, there's no rest for the wicked. You know what's coming a week from today? Quiz 2 is coming. Right? It's not waiting, so, you know. Quizzes don't wait for... So the quiz is a week from today, so I know you've just finished your DCF. You're heaving a sigh of relief. Now, I'm finally done. Well, I'm going to load your plate again. I mean, what can happen? You can't work on any of your other classes, but who cares about those anyway? So, at least I don't. So... I will send you that email out this evening about what the second quiz will cover, the past quizzes should look at, and the review session on that quiz will be posted tomorrow or day after. So it will be pretty much everything through the end of packet one. Okay? So let's get started. Let's start with some questions about what we're going to talk about today. It's patterned by now that you should know. Today we're going to talk about valuing commodity companies, financial service companies, companies in individual sectors. So here's some very basic questions about these valuations. How many of you are valuing commodity companies? Oil companies, mining companies? Nobody? I saw at least six. So you're either not admitting or those six people are not here. So here's a question about commodity companies. No, oil company, for instance. Let's face it, if you look at an oil company, its earnings go up and down as oil prices go up and down, stating the obvious. So I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. If your earnings go up and down as oil prices go up, if I look at the stock prices of oil companies, should I expect them to go up and down with the commodity price cycle as well? You see my question? We know that earnings go up and down as oil prices go up and down. Should the values of these companies also go up and down as oil prices go up and down? Rachel, you look like you know the answer to that. Tell me. You don't know the answer, but you can try.
I feel like it should.
Okay, let's go to the next step. Let's assume that oil stock prices for oil companies go up and down with oil prices. How would you make money as an investor? So basically what you would then do is you'd buy when oil prices are low because you know stock. Let me reframe this question. We know retail companies. There's 1 month of the year which accounts for 35% of the sales of every retail company. Which month is that?
December.
Do the stock prices of retail companies go up and down? Why don't they go up in December? If the revenues and the earnings are in December, why don't they go up? Because people know that December is going to be a big month. It's not like people say, oh my God, there's a December in this year. It's never happened before, right? It happens every year. Retail. So when you look at retail companies, there's almost no stock price effect around seasons. There is a commodity price effect with commodity companies, and here's why. Oil prices are low right now, right? Relative to what they used to be. Do we know that they're going to go back up? With commodity price cycles, the problem is every time commodity prices go down, we're not sure whether they're ever going to go. There have been extended periods, 25 years, where commodity prices have stayed low. So with commodity prices, there is a price effect because there's no easy way to make money. All I'm saying is if you see a seasonal or a cycle effect in your stock, if that seasonal or cycle effect is predictable, you're not going to see stock prices reflected. If it's unpredictable, like commodity prices are, you could see an effect, but it doesn't mean you can make money on it. Let's build on this thing. We're going to talk about banks today. I used to love valuing banks. I hate valuing banks now. Okay? So we're going to talk about how to value banks. And one of the things we're going to talk about is how much the value of a bank is driven by regulatory rules. In particular, banks are governed by regulatory capital requirements where they have to set aside a certain amount of capital to be able to operate as banks. And since the 2008 crisis, the regulatory authorities around the world have kept raising the regulatory capital ratios. Okay? So if your regulatory capital ratio is reflecting how much you need to do, let's suppose you're looking at a bank that is conservatively capitalized. What does it mean? They keep their capital above what the regulatory capital requirements are. So they run very safely. So here is my question about what you should expect to observe when you look at this bank. Should you expect to see a high return on equity, low risk, a low return? So let's separate it out. Let's start with the return on equity. If you as a bank hold a lot of capital, should I expect to see a lower return on equity on you or a higher return on equity? I'm going to see a lower return equity because your capital goes into your denominator and your return. So you're saying this is bad. What's the other side of the equation? Should I expect to see low risk or high risk in this bank? I should expect to see low risk. So when you see conservative banks, you're going to see low return on equity and low risk. When you see aggressive banks, you're going to see high return on equity and high risk. You think, why can't I find a bank with high return on equity and low risk? That's what we keep looking for. And if you can, load up with it. Because those are the banks that are going to have really high value. So we're going to look at why with banks you have to focus on regulatory capital and how it can affect your valuation. The last part of today's class, we're going to talk about pricing a company. We're going to start on that process of pricing a company as opposed to valuing a company. You know what you've just turned in, those of you turned in your DCFs? You turned in your values for your companies. The next phase of what you're going to be doing is you're going to be pricing the companies. And what's the difference? Pricing a company, you try to attach a number to your company based on what other people are paying for similar companies. And we'll go through the process of how to do that. But let's assume that you feel certain about the value of your stock. Nobody does, but let's say you are. You feel really good about your values, and this is it. Okay? And let's say the price and that value is much higher than the price. So your value for your company. Now, Luis, what did you value Tesla at? 262? Yeah. What's it trading at? Too close. Let's say it drops to 212. You're at 262. You feel pretty good about your valuation. Would you be willing to put all your money in the stock?
Not all of it.
Half of it? No. Quarter of it? No. 1% of it?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, let me ask you a question. Why, if you feel sure about the value of a company, would you not want to put all of your money in that stock? Want to try? But you have said you've said, let's say your value is right. You haven't made any mistakes. That could cause the value. But for you to make money, what is the other half of the equation, Rachel? you brought it into your cost of capital. That's what the cost of capital is there for. The price has to, you see, there are two halves to this. One half is you got to feel certain about your value. What's the other half that's got to happen? The price has to adjust the value. And guess what? That's not in your control. That's why I've never understood investors who say, I'm going to put all my money in the stock because I know that the value of the stock is 65. You could know that, but and that's already doubtful. But even if you know that, to make money, the price has to adjust. You can be right and you can go bankrupt being right because the price can move in the other direction. So we're going to talk about why pricing can give you a different answer and why, if you're an investor with a 3-month or a 6-month time horizon, you might prefer to price something rather than value them. So here's my final question. I don't know how you feel about graduating from business school, but let's say you graduate from business school, you don't feel good about this business job. I mean, you have to go to work at 8 o'clock every morning, work till like 7. My son complains about this all the time. He says, when am I? What? His question, he just started working 2 years ago, is when can I retire? Isn't that a little early? But no, he's already thinking about retirement. He's setting aside money. This is my retirement date. So let's say you graduate. You don't want this business job. You decide you want to become a weather forecaster. So you go to weather forecasting school. I don't even know whether there's such a school, but maybe they teach you how to have nice hair, point to blank walls, get the right state. You know that on TV when they actually point to those maps, there's no map there? Can you imagine pointing to Arizona and saying it's going to be cold in Louisiana? You're going to be fired right away. But let's say you go to weather forecasting school. You graduate at the very top of your class, and you want to be a superstar weather forecaster. You want to be the guy that they watch on TV all the time. So I'm going to give you 2 job offers. One comes from Honolulu, Hawaii. You can be on CBS Honolulu, Hawaii as the weather forecaster. And the other is in Epping, North Dakota. I don't even know where Epping is. I don't want to know. I don't want to be there. But Epping, North Dakota. You know why I picked those 2 cities? Honolulu, Hawaii has the most predictable weather in the entire country. Most predictable in what sense? The range of temperatures is the least. And if yesterday was a dry day, today is going to be a dry day. It's a very high core. So it's a very predictable weather city. Epping, North Dakota has the least predictable weather in the entire country. So I'm going to divide this question up into 2 parts. If you became a weather forecaster in one of these 2 cities, in which of these 2 cities are you more likely to be right? Honolulu, Hawaii. It's going to be 83 and sunny tomorrow. I didn't even check. You know what? I'm probably pretty close. It's always 83 and sunny in Honolulu. So if you're the weather forecaster in Honolulu, Hawaii, how much time are you going to be on TV? Who needs a weather forecaster? It's going to be 83 and sunny. You're going to be delivering coffee to the other anchor saying, okay, go away now. You're going to be really wrong in Epping, North Dakota, right? But guess what? People watch you all the time. If you watch this, when a blizzard comes towards the East Coast, how the weather forecasters start to dance. They get a dance in their step. This is like their moment of glory. The evening news starts. The guy, the lead anchor, comes on and says, "There was, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine. There was war. Call in the weather forecaster." And he comes. You come in with the pictures of the blizzards coming. You're absolutely and totally wrong, but you capture the attention for the next 27 minutes. The last 30 seconds, the anchor comes. Oh, there's lots of other stuff that happened in the world, but you don't care anyway. The blizzard is coming. If you want to be a star weather forecaster, you want to be in Epping. You think, what's this got to do with valuation? Let me pick on a few of you. Barbara, you valued Yelp, right? And Anna valued Salesforce. And Rachel valued Delta. Fernando, who did you value? So we have 2 younger startups, 2 more established companies, right? If you think about in terms of which of these valuations are more likely to be right, I would guess that valuing Delta and American Mobile is easier to do than valuing Salesforce.com and Yelp, right? So you're saying, I want to get my valuations right. Guess where you're going to go? If your objective is to have valuations that are pretty close to price, you should stick with nice, mature companies with a long history where you know exactly what they're doing. But you're in Honolulu, Hawaii. So you value Coca-Cola really well. Who cares? Anybody can value Coca-Cola. It's 83 and sunny all the time. It is true you feel more uncertain when you value the Teslas, the Salesforces, the Yelps of the world. But guess what? The payoff to doing valuation is greatest when you're most uncertain. So if as you sat down doing the valuation, you felt this gnawing in your stomach saying, I could be wrong, this is all complete guesswork. Hang in there, because those are the companies where the payoff to doing valuation is going to be greatest. So as you think about valuation, don't test yourself on how close to the right value am I. The question you should be asking is, how close to the value am I relative to other people valuing exactly the same company? And guess what? If you're valuing a Snap, you're going to be wrong, but so is everybody else. And remember what I said, you don't have to be right to make money, you just have to be less wrong than everybody else. It brings down that anxiety level, or it should, because it says this is not about getting the right answer, it's about getting a less wrong answer than everybody else, and that is going to be far more likely in Epping, North Dakota, or in Snap, than it is in Coca-Cola or in Honolulu. So whenever you think about a mature company, think Honolulu, Hawaii, weather forecaster. You never hear about him, you never see him. And whenever you think about things being uncertain, think about Epping, North Dakota. Any questions? Okay, so let's turn back to the slides. We were talking about, we're just starting on valuing emerging market companies. So I'm going to start off by talking about the challenges in valuing emerging market companies. So let's go through the questions. When I ask you, what are your cash flows from existing assets? If you're an emerging market company, a lot of what happens to you is out of your control. Why? Because you're an Argentine company, you're a Greek company, you're a Nigerian company. What's happening in the country and the macro environment can drown you out. When I ask you, what's the value from growth? Again, it's very much a function of what happens in the macro environment. When I ask you, how risky are you? You could do everything to keep a lid on risk, but if the country becomes riskier, it takes you to hell in a handbasket. And when I ask you, when will you be a mature company, that might not even be in your control anymore, because if the country is truly melting down, it could take you down with it. You see what's going to happen when you value an emerging market company? You're going to spend half your time, three-quarters of your time worrying about the country, and maybe at the very last moment, you're going to say, what does this company do? So when I valued PZ Cousins, Nigeria, much of my time was spent understanding Nigeria, the country, very little was on the company. Not because I wanted to, but because so much of what happened in the company was a function of what happened in the country. So here are a couple of things that I would suggest. One is, when you think about emerging market companies, you do tend to think about country risk. And you're right to think about country risk, but don't think of it as a cleaver, think of it as a scalpel. Don't take every Brazilian company and give it the Brazilian country risk. And this is something we've talked about with mature companies as well. Think about Brazilian companies like Embraer, which get most of their revenues outside Brazil, as less risky than Brazilian companies like Ambev. So when we talked about either lambdas or adjusting equity risk premiums, this is why we were focusing on looking at how much of your revenues came from that country. So I'll use Embraer to kind of illustrate. This is an old valuation of Embraer, where I valued Embraer in US dollars. Why did I value it in US dollars? Because in those days, getting a government bond rate in nominal real was difficult to get, so I did the entire valuation in US dollars. It's also an aerospace company. All of its contracts are denominated in US dollars, and essentially, the valuation looks very much like any other reinvestment rate. So if you look at the mechanics, everything looks okay. Above the cash flow line, everything is being done in US dollars. Let's go below the line, because that's where you're going to see the emerging market effect show up. First, the risk-free rate is a US dollar risk-free rate. Why? Because I'm doing my valuation in US dollars. It might seem like I'm giving the company an advantage by not doing things in nominal real, but remember, currency effects cancel out because they're inflation effects. To compute the cost of equity, I start with the beta for aerospace companies. Aerospace companies, not Brazilian aerospace companies, all aerospace companies. Why do you think I did all aerospace rather than just Brazilian aerospace companies? How many Brazilian aerospace companies do you think there are? There's one. It's called Embraer. I said, let me look at Latin American aerospace companies, one. Emerging market aerospace companies, one. So at some point, you've got to start expanding the sample. And let's face it, Embraer competes with Bombardier and Airbus and Boeing for contracts. I don't see any problem with using the beta for aerospace companies, unlevered beta 0.75. So my 0.88 reflects the fact that Embraer is an aerospace company.
I multiply that by mature market premium.
Hang in there. No, it's not a mature market company. I used a mature market premium. The only emerging market in 2008 that Embraer was significantly exposed to was Brazil. So this is one of those few cases we can use that lambda approach. Remember, lambda becomes very much like beta. The lambda that I estimated for Embraer, and if you don't remember where the 0.27 comes from, I don't blame you, but it's way back, 200 pages ago, when we talked about lambdas. This was the lambda we estimated. Effectively, I'm saying Embraer is a Brazilian company, not that exposed to Brazilian country risk. The net effect of feeding that all in is my cost of equity in U.S. dollar terms looks surprisingly low. It's only 8.31%. You see, but it's a Brazilian company. It is a Brazilian company, but because it gets so much of its revenues outside Brazil, I'm not punishing it with the type of cost of equity you'd see for a Brazilian company. That's what I mean by a scalpel, because if I'd attach the entire Brazilian country risk premium to Embraer, the cost of equity would have been 13 or 14%, that have knocked off about 30 to 40% of my value. Based on my judgment, the value per share that I got in reais was 15.72. It was actually trading a little higher than that at 17.2. It was overvalued, even with my bending over backwards, giving it the risk of a company that gets a big chunk of its revenues outside the country. Of course, this worked because I had only one emerging market to worry about. Let's say Embraer was in four Latin American countries and two Asian countries in terms of revenues. I'm not going to do a lambda for each one. Then I'm just going to take a weighted average, just like you did, of the equity risk premiums. Works perfectly okay. So emerging market companies are riskier, but before you decide how much risk, look at where they get the revenues, just like you would for a developed market company. So that's the first thing to keep in mind, is country risk matters. And it matters not just in the cost of equity, it does also affect the cost of debt, because it pushes up the cost of debt with that default spread for the country. Second, currency should not matter. You can value a company in dollars, in reais, in pesos. And the reason it doesn't matter, again, somebody remind me, what does it do? What does currency do to your valuation? It brings in inflation into your discount rate. It brings in inflation into your cash flow. So when you pick a high inflation currency, it feeds both up. When you bring in a low inflation currency, it pushes both down. So if you decide to value an emerging market company in any currency you want, just make sure the inflation you're building in is consistent both the numerator and the denominator. And finally, this is not just true for emerging market companies, but sometimes with emerging market companies, you feel helpless. And here's why. You look at the company, it's badly managed and badly run. Now, with a U.S. company, you usually have some light at the end of the tunnel, because if you have a badly managed, badly run company, you can at least argue that in most companies, that somebody is going to come and shake up the company and perhaps change it. With emerging market companies, you look down and there's nothing on the horizon. Your company is not just badly managed and badly run. It's a family-controlled company that is going to stay badly managed and badly run forever. And this was a question I asked you at the start of the last class about, should we be discounting the value that we get for the fact that you don't have much stockholder power? And I think the answer we came up with was what? It depends on what we built into the cash flows. If you have a badly managed, badly run company, and you brought in the lower growth rate, the terrible returns on capital, the high cost of capital, all into your valuation already, there's no reason to discount it. So I'm going to take you through an example. And this is actually an example of a valuation. This is actually a real valuation I did maybe 15 years ago for an Indian company called Tube Investments. It's a South Indian company. I've known the family for a long time. So I was back in Chennai for a visit. And now, as part of the visit, somehow I got entangled in, can you come in and value a company? And the reason they wanted me to come in was they said, look, the stock is trading at 4x earnings. The market's being so unfair to us. And I'm sure you can come up with a much higher value. So I said, I'll try. So I came in and I valued the company. And they were deeply disappointed because the stock was trading at 102. And I came up with a value of only 62 rupees per share. They said, why is our value so low? We grow a lot. And I said, that might be a problem. He said, how can growth be a problem? Well, they are growing a lot. They're reinvesting a lot. They're earning a return on capital of 9.2%. By itself, that sounds pretty good. But remember, this is early part of the last decade India, where the inflation rate was 8, 9, 10%. The risk-free rate, in fact, was 12% in rupees, which gave me a cost of equity and a cost of capital of 16.9%. So let's see what they're doing. They're reinvesting a lot. They're making a 9.2% return on capital. Their cost of capital is 16.9%. So as they're growing, what are they doing? They're destroying value.
So I finish the valuation, I come up with 62 rupees. They look at the growth rate and say, you're being far too pessimistic about growth. We can grow faster. So I said, okay, you want me to grow faster? I'll grow you faster. I grew them at 7%. Guess what happened to the price per share, the value per share? It went to 52. This is like one of those electric blankets where as you turn up the blanket gets colder, and you know, sometimes you get these dual controls on a blanket and they get mixed up. You're getting hot and you turn it and the person on the other side of the bed is freezing, so they turn. So before you know it, you're both out of the bed because you can't take it anymore. They kept increasing growth because that's the only mechanism they could think of how to increase value. Finally, they gave up because they kept pushing up the growth rate and I kept pushing down the value. They asked for some advice. How can we bring our value up? You can probably give it to them. What do they need to do? Stop growing, which they didn't want to do. They said, but so much fun growing. We have a growth company. So something more constructive. They can continue to grow if they can do what? Earn a higher return on capital or decrease the cost of capital. Decreasing the cost of capital is kind of tough because the risk-free rate is 12%. You're not going to be able to bring it down very much. So maybe you can bring it down to 15.5%. So I said, that's what you need to do, earn a higher return on capital. And to illustrate the effect, I did it in two steps. Remember, they're earning a terrible return on capital on their existing investments, right? And some of those investments, they might not be able to increase the return on capital. That sugar plant you bought and you invested too much, you're not going to get the money back. But maybe on your new investments, you can start to do better, right? So even if you say, I can't do much about my existing investments, if I can improve my return on capital on new investments. So first thing I did was I said, let's keep everything else constant. Let's assume you can do nothing about your existing investments. And you can improve your return on capital on existing investments from 9.2 to 12.2. You're still destroying value, but at least you're not destroying as much value as you used to. The value that you get is 84 rupees per share. You improve it to 16.2%, which is their cost of capital, or 16.9%. The value per share goes to about 120 rupees per share. This is just on your new investments. But if you really want the value to jump, you have to fix your existing investments, right? They're terrible investments. So the second what if I asked was, what if I can improve the return on capital in existing investments? What does that require? That you cut costs and improve income in existing investments? If you can improve the return on capital in existing investments, the value per share that I get is 111 rupees. So let's think about how I got from 62 to 84 to 111. The 62 reflects a badly managed, badly run company that continues to reinvest in bad projects and tries to grow, which is what they were doing. The $84 reflects a company with bad existing investments that's trying to do better on the new investments. And the 111 rupees per share reflects a company that is not only able to do this on new projects, but also on existing projects. The corporate governance discount is already embedded in there because in all of these valuations, I'm assuming that the company is set on growing and there's nothing I can do to stop it. Because if this were a company where there was strong corporate governance, you're right, I'd ask them to stop growing and perhaps even start liquidating their business, getting smaller. That is at the heart of what you have to think about in corporate governance. Any questions on emerging market companies? One final point is those cross-holdings we talked about, and we talked about this in the context of loose ends and valuation. An issue again with lots of companies, but with emerging market companies that are part of family groups, they can be out of control. They can take on a big chunk of the value of the company. How much? Let me account for 20, 25, 30. Let me show you, in fact, and this is actually important. Don't try to read this page. It's just meant to not be read. It's actually an evaluation I did for the Tata Group in April of 2010. Tata Group is a big family group in India. And I valued four Tata companies, Tata Motors, Tata Steel, Tata Chemicals, and TCS. The reason I say that is each of these companies, I did what you conventionally do. You project out free cash flow, discount back at the cost of capital. Let's take, for instance, Tata Motors. What I get as a value for the operating assets by discounting the cash flows is about 231.9 billion rupees. I added cash, which is about 11.4 billion. You think so far we're doing everything we did before? Then I added cross holdings. The cross holdings were 141 billion rupees. It's almost 40% of the value of the company comes from cross holdings. We talked a little bit about this with family group companies. How do you think Tata Motors ended up with all these cross holdings? They do it just to screw you over, make your life difficult. This is not, I mean, this is the rule rather than the exception. You see that with Tata Steel and Tata Chemicals as well, is big cross holdings. How do family group companies end up with these cross holdings? Where did they come from? What are the origins? Until the 1980s, these were privately owned family group businesses. So here's how it would work. 1974, let's say Tata Steel is a really good year and Tata Motors has to build a new plant. What did the family do? They take the Tata Motors earnings and they would reinvest it in Tata Motors and now the Tata Steel earnings and put in Tata Motors. And the accountants would just then put to make sure the accounting worked, would give Tata Motors a piece of Tata Steel. Or Tata Steel, I forget now, Tata Steel, a piece of Tata Motors. Every time a company invests in another company in the group, you're going to get a cross-holding. This is not a conspiracy. This is a direct consequence of those internal capital markets that these companies used to have. And Tata Motors, Tata Steel, and Tata Chemicals, a big chunk of the value comes from these cross-holdings. But TCS doesn't have very much. Why? Tata Motors, Tata Steel, and Tata Chemicals seem to have big cross-holdings. Tata Consulting Services, which is the largest of the Tata groups and the youngest, and I'm giving you a clue there, has very little cross-holdings. Why is that? Well, they're so young that they never had a chance to do these. They came about. They were born after the Tata group went public. And guess what? For them, the cross-holdings is less of an issue. What it also means is when you value a family group company and you do a DCF, you're valuing only that part of the company that is the DCF. You could get 30, 40, 45% of your value coming from those cross holdings. And those cross holdings, if we want to do it right, what do we have to do? Value every single piece of those cross holdings. And Tata Motors has 41 cross holdings in other Tata companies. God help you even trying to value those because most of them are actually private businesses. Which effectively means that with these companies, a big chunk of what you're paying for, you really don't even get to do your due diligence on. So there's my breakdown. You can see 47% of Tata Chemicals value comes from cross-holdings. That's almost equal to your... So the blue is my DCF value. The red is the cross-holdings value, and you can see how much of the value of each company comes from that cross-holdings, in addition to being a control issue, create a valuation issue. And you can see TCS has the smallest slice of cross-holdings. Any questions on those issues with emerging market companies? One final point about emerging market companies, and again, this is not specific to emerging market companies, but you probably worry about it more with emerging market companies. Truncation risk, which is the risk that your company will not make it, is always a clear and present danger in many emerging market companies. And can come from three places. It can come from natural disasters. I remember doing a session in Antigua. Why was it in Antigua? It was winter in New York, and anybody invited me outside New York, I just took the invitation. And I was talking to businessmen in Antigua about valuation. And we talked about risk after risk after risk, and they said, that doesn't apply to us, that doesn't apply to us. And I got through my whole list of lists, and none of those risks apply to us. So what's your biggest risk? You know what they're worried about is their biggest risk? Think Antigua, what's their biggest business? Think any Caribbean island, what's its biggest business? Tourism, right? Many of them own hotels or businesses that fed into tourism. You know the risk they're worried about the most? It's the risk of a hurricane. Natural disasters. Because they said, if we get a really bad hurricane, that can wipe out the entire tourist season in our valuation. Truncation risk. You could build a great business one hurricane away from being blown away. It could be terrorism risk, right? You build a great business, you're in a part of the world where things are unstable, your business could get blown up, and there goes the value of your business. Or if you're in parts of the world where the government is moody, decides, you know, it likes your company a lot, and decides to take your company over and not pay you fair value, it's nationalization risk. And with all of those risks, do what we did with distress risk. How do we deal with distress risk? We value the company as if these risks did not exist, and then we ask two questions. What is the likelihood that I will get nationalized? There'll be a terrorist attack. There'll be a national disaster or natural disaster. ask yourself what the consequences of that will be, and take an expected value. Any questions on any, because none of those are specific to emerging market companies, but if any of those were underlying your valuation, think about how that affected your valuation. Now let's talk about financial service companies. First rule with financial service companies is never do firm valuation. You know what I mean by firm valuations? Don't try to do free cash flow to the firm and cost of capital, because for a bank, debt is not a source of capital, it's raw material. So everything has to stay equity focused. And when you think about answering the questions, what are your cash flows, what is the value added, how risky are your cash flows, and when will your firm be a mature firm? At least with banks, you're looking at financial assets and how they will pay off for your company. So basically with banks, you know, when you think about what are my cash flows, you're looking at equity cash flows, equity income, and it's not even clear what you mean by reinvestment in a bank. Coming up with cash flow for a bank can be difficult to do. When you think about excess returns, a lot of it can be driven by regulatory capital requirements. You could be making more than your cost of equity, but if I raise your capital requirements 30%, there goes your excess return. And when I ask you how risky are you, much of the risk I'm worried about is what if you don't have enough regulatory capital? What if the regulatory agencies shut you down? So let's think about valuing a bank, and I'm going to take you back in time to more innocent times. Pre-2008, if you looked at any of my valuation books, you got to the chapter on valuing banks. The chapter would start off with a sentence. Valuing banks is easy. Most dangerous statement to make. But those were built on two implicit assumptions. The first was that banks were run by sensible people. And the second was that banks paid out what they could afford to. In cash. And also that they were regulated by regulatory authorities who made sure they didn't take too much risk. See why I need those two assumptions? Pre-2008, the way I used to value banks is with the dividend discount model. And when you use a dividend discount model, what are you assuming? That the dividend that gets paid out reflects what could be paid out, which requires sensible management, and that the bank is not taking some insane risks under the surface that you're not even aware of. Banks are incredibly opaque. When you look at the financial statements for a bank, you're at their mercy. You have no idea what's going on underneath. You need somebody, a regulatory authority, to keep those risks in line. So if you asked me to value a bank, I'd project out the dividends, discount the dividends back, said that's the value of the bank. I still do that for some banks, but I'm much less willing to do it because I don't trust the regulatory authorities to keep a lid on this. And I don't think banks are run by sensible people. But once in a while, you know, I'd run into a bank and say, I'll use a dividend discount model. So here's one attempt. This is actually an Egyptian bank called CIB. It's a fairly, you know, large, well-known Egyptian bank. And this evaluation I did in December of 2015 in Egyptian pounds. So let's start building up to the valuation. If I want to value an Egyptian bank in Egyptian pounds, I need a risk-free rate in Egyptian pounds, right? So how do we get risk-free rates in other currencies? What do we start with? You go looking for a government bond denominated in Egyptian pounds, and I couldn't find any. The Egyptian government doesn't have long-term bonds. They don't borrow the bond market. So here's how I came up with the risk-free rate in Egyptian pounds. I started with the US dollar risk-free rate. You're saying, that's not the Egyptian pound. You're right, it's not the Egyptian pound risk-free rate. But I also got inflation rate estimates for the US and Egypt. The inflation rate for the Egypt was 9.7%. The inflation rate for the US is 1.5%. What I'm doing is I'm scaling up my risk-free rate in dollar terms for the additional inflation in Egyptian pounds. So basically, I end up with a risk-free rate of 10.53% in Egyptian pounds. A little more tricky than looking up a government bond rate and netting out default spreads, but I can do this with any currency, differential inflation. The beta that I use is the average beta for banks. I'm assuming that the average bank is pretty much of the same risk, so I'm using that 0.81. And the equity risk premium I used reflected the equity risk premium for Egypt, because this is one of those cases where the bank gets 100% of its business in Egypt. That's going to give me an astonishingly high cost of equity, 23.25%. I projected out the dividends, you know, based upon what, in fact, the earnings growth here comes from what their return equity is, which is sky high, 42%. Why? Because the Egyptian banking business is very tough to enter into. They're very profitable. And they pay out about 25% of those earnings as dividends. So they retain 75%. So 32% growth rate pushes up earnings. Every year they pay out a portion, and as their growth starts to slow, look at what starts to happen to their payout ratio. They can pay out more of their earnings as dividends. Discount them back at the cost of equity. The value per share that I get in Egyptian pounds is about 42 pounds per share. Stock was actually trading at 36. So ask me the question. Did I buy? I really wanted to. You know how difficult it is to actually buy 1,000 shares of an Egyptian stock? You call Charles Schwab and say, I'd like to buy 1,000 shares of CIB, Egypt. They can't even find it. You'll have to find somebody in Egypt who can buy these shares for you. So I actually had to give up finally because I don't know anybody in Egypt that I trust enough to send cash on. Can you buy 1,000 shares? Okay. But this is a classic bank valuation where you're discounting dividends back at the cost of equity. And this is how we used to value every bank. As I said, I've learned better that this is not a good way to value banks anymore. And in fact, I'll show you my final dividend discount model valuation for a U.S. bank / investment bank before I learned my lesson. This was my valuation of Goldman Sachs in August of 2008. What's coming 1 month down the road? September of 2008, the crisis hits, right? You're saying, why did you see that coming? If I saw that coming, why would I be valuing individual stocks? I'd be making money elsewhere. So August of 2008, I had no idea what was coming. I valued banks and investment banks using the dividend discount model. And in August of 2008, here's what Goldman Sachs looked like. They paid out about 8.35% of their earnings as dividends, which means they reinvested about 92%. Their return on equity was about 13%. You take the product of those two numbers, I give them a growth rate of about 12% a year. Why is it so high? Because they're reinvesting a big chunk of their earnings back. I project out earnings for the next 10 years. And I, again, as the growth drops off, you'll see my payout ratio start to climb. Again, why? Because if I'm not growing as fast, I don't have to reinvest as much. At the end of year 10, I make them a mature company. I do exactly what I would do for a traditional company. Come up with my expected earnings per share in year 10, project out one more year, payout ratio in steady state. I come up with a terminal value of about $477 per share. I discount it all back at my cost of equity, risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium. And you discount back at the 10.4%, the present value that I get for dividends is 220. One of the nice things about the dividend discount model is you don't have to think about cash and cross holdings. It's all in those dividends. Value per share that I got was about 222. Stock was trading at 169. Did I buy? I wanted to, but I was lazy and I kept putting it off. And this is one of those things. I would love to say that I had the foresight of coming doom, and that's why I was just putting it off. What can happen in 3 weeks, 2 weeks? And of course, I'm glad I put it off because in September 12th, the bottom fell out. You know what Goldman Sachs was trading at in the start of November of 2008? It's trading at $75 per share. So if I'd bought it at 169, I'd have lost more than half my money. In fact, at $75 per share is when Warren Buffett took a position in the stock. So this is a stock where the bottom fell out. And the bottom fell out precisely because I was factoring in dividends that could not be sustained as the crisis kicked in. That was the last investment banking / banking valuation where I completely trusted the dividend discount model. Which left me actually in 2008 in a very strange place because I said, I don't trust dividends paid by banks, but what am I going to do instead? The reason we use the dividend discount model for banks is not because we want to, but to get to cash flows is a nightmare. Think about it. To get to free cash flow equity, which is what I would need here with an equity valuation, I start with net income, right? Can I get that for a bank? Absolutely. Then what's the next step? What do I subtract out from net income to get to cash flow? Net capex, change in working capital. What's net capex for a bank? What's capex for a bank? What is working capital for a bank? Current assets, try that with a bank. It could be everything, it could be nothing. The reason we use the dividend discount model is a sign of desperation. For a long time, trying to compute the cash flow for a bank was close to impossible. We threw up our hands and said, it can't be done, therefore I have to use dividends. And that would have been my defense in 2008. So after the crisis, I said, I can't use that defense anymore. This is not working because I cannot just discount dividends at a bank and come up with a value per share. I need to come up with the equivalent of a free cash flow equity. So here's what I'm going to do. And you're going to see this play out in my valuation. If a bank has to grow, it doesn't need land and building and equipment and machinery and factories, right? What does a bank need to do to be able to grow? Remember that regulatory capital we talked about? If you don't invest in regulatory capital, you can't grow because your regulatory capital ratios determine whether you can grow. See where I'm going to go next? I'm going to start with your net income. I'm going to look at what you reinvest back in regulatory capital as the equivalent of net capex. And when I subtract out that regulatory capital, I'm going to end up with a value for the bank which reflects its free cash flow equity, its potential dividends, rather than the actual dividends. So here, for instance, my transition started in October and November when I was trying to value banks. I was still using the dividend discount model. And what I was noticing was the dividends didn't change very quickly. Banks were continuing to pay dividends even though the crisis was unfolding. Here's a valuation of Wells Fargo where I did focus on the dividends per share. But as I was doing the valuation, part of me was screaming, you can't use this. This is not going to be the dividend for very long. They can't afford to pay these dividends. So part of what's going to drive my shift in how I think about valuing banks is to think about how to estimate that free cash flow equity. Okay? So let's think about how this free cash flow equity is going to be estimated. I'm going to start with my net income. I'm going to think about how much I need to reinvest in regulatory capital, and that's going to be driven by two things. One is, how much regulatory capital do I already have? If I'm an undercapitalized bank, what does that mean? I need to come up with a lot of capital in the next few months, next few years to keep going. And if I'm a growth bank, a bank that wants to grow, I need to reinvest more in regulatory capital. So to get my free cash flow equity, I'm going to start with the net income. I'm going to subtract out what I need to reinvest in regulatory capital. When I do that, could my free cash flow equity be negative for a bank? Deutsche, last October, was hopelessly undercapitalized. Because it was hopelessly undercapitalized, one of your valuations of the week, they have to come up with about $8 to $11 billion in new capital. There is no chance that their free cash flow equity is going to be positive, at least as far as the eye can see, maybe for the next 3 or 4 years. They need to raise so much capital just to get back, not even because they're growing, just to get back to what they need to have. So when we talk about free cash flow equity, now get the freedom to decide that some banks actually have negative free cash flow equity. And that is basically what will drive the valuation of a bank, is what those free cash flows to equity look like. So this was actually Deutsche in 2013, in pleasanter times, when they were not as much trouble as they are now. Here's how I estimated the free cash flow to equity. Start with the net income, which is easy to project. And then I estimated how much regulatory capital they will need every year for the next 5 years. And to do this, I've got to make some assumptions about how much the asset base is growing, how much the regulatory capital ratios are changing. So if you look at Deutsche, their regulatory capital will have to increase by 1.146 billion euros in year one. I subtract that as reinvestment to come up with my free cash flow equity. So every year, I take the net income, I subtract out what I need to invest in regulatory capital, and my free cash flow equity then becomes what I discount. Okay? And that free cash flow equity, as I said, can be negative, it can be a big positive number, but you're capturing more sensibly what your company can actually, or what your bank can actually pay out in dividends. So this is my March 2009 valuation of Deutsche. In better times, their free cash flows to equity are all positive. So instead of discounting dividends, I'm discounting back these big free cash flows to equity. I'm discounting them back at the cost of equity that reflects the risk of the bank by capturing where they do business, much higher cost of equity. What I get as a present value, 53.94 euros per share. It was pretty close to the price per share. This was after the price had collapsed. A lot of people were claiming Deutsche is a bargain, it's collapsed, but if you look at the value per share with the reinvestment that they would need, you essentially see that the stock is pretty close to fairly priced. So if you're doing an insurance company, an investment bank, or a bank, I know many of you are doing banks, I think there are about a dozen of you, have done the dividend discount model. You can stay with the dividend discount model, but one of the things you might want to look at is the regulatory capital ratios for your bank to see if this is the kind of bank that might need a lot more capital. Because if it is, you've in a sense overvalued your bank. Let's talk about companies with intangible assets, pharmaceutical companies, technology companies. When you look at these companies again, your starting point is exactly the same as it would be for any other company. What are your cash flows? What's the value from growth? How risky is this company? When will my company be a mature company? But answering those questions is much more difficult with companies with intangible assets. And the reason is simple. The accountants have no idea what they're doing. Let's start with, how much did you make last year, right? What do we look at? We look at net income and operating income, right? Company. But when you look at a pharmaceutical company or a technology company, you can already see you're in trouble because that operating income is after R&D, which is your biggest capex. So we have a cleaning up to do. Then ask you, what's your value for growth? The driver of the value of growth is, what's your return on capital? What's your cost of capital? The problem with a company with intangible assets is, because of the accounting again, what I see as return on capital in your accounting statements doesn't reflect your true return on capital. That's why we capitalize R&D. I can't even tell whether you're adding value or destroying value while you grow. When I ask you, how risky are you? Let's face it. Companies with intangible assets are more difficult to borrowing money. So the debt ratios can't climb to 40 or 50%. They're going to be capped off at a much lower number. And finally, if you try to liquidate a company with intangible assets, God only knows what you'll get, because these intangible assets can have no value. It's not like liquidating a building or selling off a building. So again, the questions become more difficult, not because we don't know how to answer them, but because the accounting data we get is so flawed. So here's what we did with accounting companies with intangible assets. We fixed the accounting problems. In particular, we capitalize R&D. By capitalizing R&D, let's look at the effects. First, you bring your biggest asset onto the books, so your capital invested goes up. Second, you adjust your operating income for how efficiently you're doing R&D, which means your operating income could go up or down when you capitalize R&D. And your return on capital can be dramatically different after you capitalize R&D. So I don't know whether you remember, but I actually took Amgen and I capitalized its R&D. Basically, what I've done here is I've given Amgen's R&D a 10-year life. I've capitalized the R&D, and that gives me two numbers. The R&D that is uncapitalized is what goes into my balance sheet as an asset, $13.2 billion. And the amortization of R&D is $1.694 billion. So I'm going to take the numbers that I have for Amgen, compare the numbers that I've had if I trusted the accountants with the numbers I'm getting with R&D capitalized. So the net income, if you look at the income statement, says $4,196 million. When I capitalize R&D, that number jumps to $5.53 billion. When I book value of equity, if I trust the accountants, they have $17.9 billion. Once I capitalize R&D, that becomes $31.2 billion. Operating return on equity is 23.48%. After I capitalize R&D, that number drops. My pre-tax operating income jumps. My return on capital decreases. So basically, I'm getting a very different picture for the company. So if you've used my spreadsheets, if you remember, the way I treat R&D is I ask you, do you have R&D expenses to capitalize? And I ask you yes or no, right? And if you say yes, then I ask you for information on the R&D, and I do the cleaning up for you. So I did that for Amgen. I came up with the value per share. And I was just curious as to what would have happened if I just treated R&D like the accountants do. So I changed the yes to no. And you can try this. If you capitalize R&D on your spreadsheet, try this out. Take the yes, make it no, see what happens to your value per share. I'll show you what happened at Amgen. And then you can try to tell me why you see what's happening in Amgen. So basically, I'm going to show you two valuations, one with the accounting treatment of R&D as an expense, one with my capitalizing R&D. With my capitalizing R&D, the value that I got for Amgen was about $74 per share. So basically, what you see here is every number reflects my capitalization of R&D. My operating income is actually with R&D capitalized. My net capex is with R&D capitalized. So everything in this analysis is with R&D capitalized. The value that I got was $74 per share. So I've turned the yes on the R&D option. I've done the whole valuation with R&D as part of a capital expenditure. Then I turned the R&D button off. Here's what I got as my value. My value with the R&D capitalized was 74. My R&D with accounting treatment for R&D is about $32 per share lower. At least in the case of Amgen, by capitalizing R&D, I'm almost doubling the value of the company. This sounds like something you should do for all pharma companies, right? I did the same thing for Merck. And my value per share dropped when I capitalized R&D by about 25%. So here's my question for you. You have Amgen and Merck, both pharmaceutical companies. I'm capitalizing R&D in both companies. In the case of Amgen, when I capitalize R&D, my value per share jumps by $32 per share. In the case of Merck, when I capitalize R&D, my value per share drops by 25%. Why do you think that is? Basically, when you capitalize R&D, what are you doing? You're bringing it to the level of a capital investment, right? When you expand and invest in assets, will that increase value or decrease value? What does it depend on? It depends on the return on capital you make on that investment relative to the cost of capital. In the case of Amgen, here's what I'm finding. When I capitalize R&D and I look at the return I'm making on that R&D, I'm making a return much higher than the cost of capital, and capitalizing R&D increases my value. When I did the same thing for Merck, the return on capital I got was one-third my cost of capital. So when I capitalize R&D, I'm actually destroying value. And that's why we capitalize R&D. It's not because we like to do these little dances around R&D. It's to get a much better sense of, is this the kind of company where R&D is adding value or destroying value? Because without knowing the answer to that question, I don't see how you can value any technology company or pharmaceutical company. So think of this as the end result of capitalizing R&D, is the numbers get more meaningful, and especially those numbers on return on capital and cost of capital. Let's close off this section on businesses by looking at commodity businesses. Again, if you look at the four questions, what are your cash flows, what's the value from growth, how risky are you, when will you be a mature company? With commodity companies, each of these numbers, the answers you get will depend on what the commodity price is. So let's start with the first one. You're an oil company. So what did you make last year? It'll depend on whether oil prices were $100 or $40, right? So your earnings are going to go up and down with oil prices. When I ask you what's the value from future growth, again, the investments you made when oil was at $100 that created value for you might be destroying value for you today because that return on capital has dropped off. When you think about risk for an oil company, a big chunk of your risk comes from commodity prices moving all over the place. And if you're a commodity company with a lot of debt, even if you're a well-managed company, if oil prices drop by 50%, you're going to be in big trouble. Everything you do is driven by this macro effect of what's happening to the commodity. So here's the problem you all often face with companies where a macro input is driving your valuation. You feel helpless. You do everything right, and the oil price moves $15, your valuation will move with it. And after a while, you feel the urge to make macro assumptions. You know what I mean by macro assumptions? You're valuing an oil company, you want to bring your point of view about oil prices into your valuation. So let's say you did that. Oil prices right now are about $55 a barrel. Let's say you think that oil prices are going to go back to 100. You're valuing Royal Dutch. So you project out oil prices going from 55 to 100. What's going to happen to your earnings? They're going to go up. You're going to come up with high cash flows. You're going to discount those cash flows. You're probably going to come up with a value about 40% higher than the current stock price. And then what are you going to tell me to do? Buy Royal Dutch, right? Let me ask you a question. Why are you finding Royal Dutch to be cheap? Is it because you like Royal Dutch, the company, or because you feel that oil prices will go up to $100 a barrel? I have no way of knowing. You're saying, why does it matter? Why does it matter what's driving your recommendation, whether it's your view on oil prices or whether it's your view on Royal Dutch? Yes, Rachel. And if you're really good at predicting oil prices, there's a much easier way for me to make money, right? Which is? Go buy oil price futures. Why would I want to entangle myself in a British/Dutch oil company that I don't know what they're doing? If I have a strong view on commodity prices and I'm really good at forecasting commodity prices, why waste your time valuing commodity companies? Just go make money. And if you're really bad at forecasting oil prices, then I'm screwed, right? Because I buy Royal Dutch, trusting you. You turn out to be horrible at forecasting oil prices. I'm really good at the company, but I bought the stock for exactly the wrong reasons. I know this is really tough to do. But when you value commodity companies, leave your macro views outside the room. Value the oil company at today's oil prices. You can use the futures curve because that's based on today's oil prices. Don't make it a point of view valuation. Part of you is going to scream, but oil prices could change. I know they can change. But you want to make this evaluation that stands on the company, not on your views about future prices of iron ore or oil. Okay? So the macro assumption is always going to be lurking in the background. You'll want to go towards it, try to avoid it. Don't make this a point about your macro views. And I'd say the same thing about exchange rates and country risk and oil prices. You'd be tempted to bring all of those in. Leave them outside the room. And after you're done with the valuation, then I'm going to open the door. To what? Oil prices can change. We all know that. There is a way in which you can sensibly bring in those changes without exposing yourself to dramatic amounts of estimation risk. So I'll give you an example. Last year, I was asked to value Royal Dutch. Actually, I did it for their finance group. And I said, no, look, I'll value Royal Dutch for you. The oil prices were about $40 a barrel when I did this valuation. So I decided to value Royal Dutch at the $40 oil price. So I'm not an oil price forecaster. I'm going to take the oil price as a given and value it, which required a whole set of adjustments I had to make. Here's the first thing I had to clean up. Their existing operating income from the trailing 12 months, I couldn't use. And here's why. The average oil price in the 12 months leading into my valuation was $55 a barrel, and the oil price had dropped to 40. So I knew the operating income would be lower at today's oil price. So the first thing I did was I adjusted the oil price for the fact that, or the revenues for the fact that oil prices were down. I computed the operating income. So everything I did here is based on the presumption that the correct oil price is today's oil price. So what you see is the value per share, $39.31, reflects today's oil price, $40. Now that number could change, right? It could change, go to 50, it could go to 30. We know what's going to happen to the value when prices change. If oil price goes to 50, the value is going to go up. The oil price goes to 30, so that's kind of a given. So here's what I did. I took the one variable that was out of my control, oil prices, and I made it a distribution. And to understand how this distribution is going to be linked up to my value, I'm going to show you the operating income, I'm sorry, the revenues at Royal Dutch going back to 1989 and the oil price each year. So all I did was I took the revenues every year and I took the average oil price every year. Take a look at those two lines. In fact, if you did an R squared between revenues at Royal Dutch and the price of oil, the R squared would have been 96.44%. If you're valuing Royal Dutch, who's the CEO of Royal Dutch? You don't know, and you don't care. Now, what's the CEO going to do here? It's all driven by oil prices. This is almost entirely an oil price play. So we know that if oil prices change, the revenues will change. In fact, what I did was I created a regression of revenues against oil prices just to see how much oil prices affect. And for every $1 increase in oil prices, Royal Dutch's revenues increased by almost $4 billion. So as oil prices change, I have a way of projecting what your revenues are going to be. So here's the final piece of what I did. I don't know whether any of you have used Crystal Ball, the add-on to Excel that allows you to use simulations. I've talked a little bit about this in other contexts. But basically what it lets you do is instead of entering a point estimate for a number, it lets you enter a distribution. In this valuation, I used a $40 oil price, right? But that number could change. So what I did was I fed in a distribution for oil prices, which effectively came from looking at the past. So I knew oil prices can change over time. I said the $40 price is the current price. But what if instead of putting in a $40 price, I put in a distribution? You're saying, what does that even mean? Here's how a simulation works. The computer goes in and picks a number out of the oil price distribution. That number could be higher than 40. Let's say it picks 65. I estimate what your revenues would need to be using that $65 oil price. That's why I had to run the regression. So with the $65 oil price, your revenues will be about almost $100 billion higher. Remember, you get about $4 billion. So I come up with the revenues. With the revenues that are $100 billion higher, I'm going to get much higher earnings, much higher cash flows, and my value per share is probably going to be $77. So that's the first simulation. Then I put the number back and I redo it. This time I pull up 26. Remember, it's a distribution. I redo the valuation. And this time I'm going to get much lower revenues and a value of maybe $14 per share. And I do it again. The default in Crystal Ball is it does this 100,000 times. It's actually almost magical because you can actually watch the distribution kind of forming in front of your eyes. So you can take your Excel spreadsheets and make them simulations. One extra step. You can just put the Crystal Ball in. You can make any input in it. And here's the bottom line. When it's all done, after the 100,000 simulations, it gives you a distribution of values for Royal Dutch. You're saying, what the hell am I going to do with the distribution? I have to buy or sell the stock. But when you get a distribution, you also get deciles, right? You can the 10th decile. So here's the first thing you can do. You can look at the median value, the 50th percentile. It's about $37, which is pretty close to what I think I got as my base valuation, 39. You say, why did I waste my time doing that extra stuff? Let's say the stock is trading at 42. What is the chance that this stock is undervalued? What do I need to do? Basically, count the number of outcomes that are higher than 42. And if I count the number of outcomes, I get about 34% of the time. So if you're an investor and you ask me, should I buy Royal Dutch? Not only can I tell you whether the stock is under or overvalued, I can tell you the likelihood that the stock is under or overvalued. Can I give you best case and worst case? It's in the distribution, either extreme. Right? The best case outcome that I have for Royal Dutch is it could be worth 197, but don't hold your breath expecting that to happen. The worst case is it could be $7. But you don't make decisions on best or worst case. But now instead of using one number, which is what you have in a DCF value, I give you a lot more information on which you can base your decisions. Why don't more people do this? Because 30 years ago, doing this would have required a mainframe computer and a couple of $100,000. So in 1985, I wanted to do a simulation. I would have said, no, it's not doable. It's not practical. Today, crystal ball, if you're a student, you can buy for $100. Buy it while you're a student. It becomes $600 the day you graduate. Okay? Buy it, it's actually free. Stern has it installed on the PCs downstairs. You don't even have to buy it. In fact, if you don't want to buy it and you're too lazy to go downstairs, go to the Oracle website and you can download a free full version. It's a trial version. It has a 30-day life and then it expires. Just try it out. It's an incredibly powerful tool because it kind of allows us to face up to that uncertainty we're trying to run away from, right? Because we make inputs. When I asked you what your revenue growth was, think about it. Be honest. Think about how uncertain you felt about that number, right? You say, is it 8? Should I put 10? About 12? And after you enter, you say, I have no idea what I just did. What if instead of giving you one number, I said, give me a distribution? And you said, it could be any number from 6 to 14. I said, okay, that's realistic. You don't know much about this company. Let's put 6 to 14. Then I asked you, what's your beta? And you said, well, I came up with 0.9 using this group, and I came up with 0.8 using this group. Give me a range. Give me a distribution. And with each input, I will then feed that distribution in and give you a distribution of values. Okay. So try the tool out. The one thing you will have to invest in to use Monte Carlo simulations is when you go into a cell after you've installed Crystal Ball, and you say, I want to make this a distribution. It'll ask you, what type of distribution do you want to use? And it'll give you 53 choices. It'll start with Bernoulli distribution. You say, what the hell is that? I've never heard of that one. And that's the reaction you have after distribution, exponential. Never heard of that. I've never heard of that. No. And then finally, we'll hit normal, and you'll say, that sounds like something I've heard about. So most simulations, here's what tends to happen. Because people don't want to think about it. Everything gets normally distributed. Life isn't a normal distribution. Prices are not a normal distribution. Why? What's the lowest price you can have? Zero. Almost by definition, we know that prices... So if you're going to use Crystal Ball, that's the one thing I'd like you to spend some time investing in is... I know you sold your statistics book the minute that class ended saying, thank God this class is over. I will never need this book again. You don't even need to buy the book back. I have a little paper. It's not the most fun paper to read about fitting distributions to variables. What's a Bernoulli distribution? What's left tail? What's right tail? What's skewed? You know, it's about 20 pages long. At the end of the 20 pages, if you open up Crystal Ball, you'll at least have a sense of what type of distribution to use for a particular variable. But the output is well worth it because you now get a distribution of values that you can use in making your decisions. So let's close this process up. Everything I've talked about up to this page, what is it, 300 and something pages, has been about intrinsic value, right? And what are we trying to do? We're trying to attach a value to a business based on its cash flows, its growth, and its risk. That's what all of this was about. So all of that feeds into value. You know what we're going to do next? We're going to talk about price. What drives price? And I said this right at the start. It's demand and supply. What drives demand and supply? God only knows. It could be mood. It could be momentum. It could be fundamentals. So we're going to shift away from value to price. And to illustrate this, I'm going to give you a couple of very simple examples. I'm going to be on sabbatical next year because my wife and I are moving to San Diego. So this happened like 3 winters ago is when the seeds of this happened. In the middle of a snowstorm. I hate snowstorms because you got a shovel. I actually did a blog post in Snowmen and Shovels about how kids and adults look at snowstorms very differently. I think shovels. When I see snow, I think shovels. So if you live in a rental building, thank the God that you don't have to shovel. This was a particularly bad snowstorm, like 3 feet of snow. It took all morning to get the snow off the driveway. We don't even have that big a driveway. I came in, I threw the shovel. I don't even know why I walked in with the shovel into the house. I threw the shovel into the corner and said, we've got to get out of here. My wife's been waiting for those words for 20-something years. Because she grew up in Marin. She never saw snow. She hates the cold. So I finished saying this. She's at the computer checking houses out. And for whatever reason, she decides to pick the most expensive part of the most expensive state to go look for a house. A place called La Jolla, right in the middle of San Diego. And this is a hovel, a hut in La Jolla. How do I know it's a hut? There are only 6 numbers in the price. La Jolla, if you see only 6 numbers, you start dancing. This must be a really cheap house. But here's my question. You've got $995,000 as a house. This is a nice lady, Lisa Padilla, to the side, who seems to know what she's doing. How did Lisa come up with this $995,000 for this house? Did she do a discounted cash flow valuation, you think? How do realtors come up with numbers to attach to houses and apartments? What do they do, Rachel? They look at other houses that have sold around the neighborhood. They adjust for the fact that you have an extra bedroom and a bigger backyard, and they do a little tweaking. They don't value houses, they price them. You're saying those unsophisticated realtors. You're right. Let's pick up a sell-side equity research report. What do you see? You see a stock. You see a buy or a sell recommendation. I've hidden the name of the equity research analyst. But if you look at how the equity research analyst attached a buy or a sell to the stock, think of what he or she did. They looked at the stock and they compared it to other stocks they claim are just like it. They use some multiple, price earnings, EV to EBITDA, kind of a pricing. And they said, this stock is cheap because it trades at less than these other stocks. Now I want an honest answer to the next question. Who do you think is on more solid ground? The realtor who attached a price to your house based on 6 houses, just like yours in the neighborhood, or the sell-side equity research analyst who's valuing Microsoft, who's claimed to have found 15 other companies just like Microsoft? I don't even think it's close. I'd take the realtor every single time. We do pricing with stocks all the time, but we're on very weak ground because it's very difficult to find 6 companies just like yours. So as we think about pricing, that's what I wanted to start thinking about because we know what drives value. As I said, those 4 questions. What are your cash flows? What's the value growth? So when I want to value a company, I know I need answers to these 4 questions. And that's what we try to do in discounted cash flow valuation is answer those 4 questions. But when I think about price, here's what drives price. The first is mood and momentum. You know what I mean by that? People are in a good mood, they push up the price. Mood shifts, the price drops. Remember those first 2 days after Snap went public? People couldn't get enough of the stock. The stock opens at 21, it goes to 24, 24 to 27. There's no good reason. Nothing fundamental came out, but the mood was good. 3 days later, what happened? For some reason, the mood shifted. The 27 started going the other direction, got down to 19, and that same mood that pushed the stock up pushed the stock down. It's mood and momentum. Second, when you think about liquidity, it matters a lot in pricing because the price is driven by demand and supply. If you have a lot of liquidity, the way that demand and supply plays out as a price can be very different than if you have very light liquidity. That's why when you look at things like float, which is a percentage of a company that's traded, it matters more for pricing than for valuation. So in valuation, I didn't care whether your float was 6% or 60%, but if I'm pricing. No. There's a lot of groupthink in pricing. What does that mean? Where do you get the most information? When you're on the market, you're trading on stocks, you're pricing. What are you looking at? You're looking at everybody else trading, right? Because your biggest information is what are they doing. This is the classic Keynesian perspective. If you've ever read this, I think Keynes described the stock market as a beauty contest where you're a judge, but your job is to not judge the best-looking person on the stage. Your job is to come up with the judgment of what the other judges think the best looking person. So basically, you're looking at the other judges. You're not even looking at the stage. Same thing with pricing. And finally, pricing is driven by incremental information. What is that? Small pieces of news. You look at it and say, that caused the price to do what? I still remember watching, I track Apple on my computer all the time, the stock price. So one morning I come in and I see the stock price down 6%. You know, it's 6% of a $600 billion company, right? $36 billion wiped out. So what the hell happened here? So I started looking, what's the news story? And it turned out that what triggered the sale was a tweet by somebody supposedly in Shanghai. Supposedly. We have no idea where he was tweeting from. And here's what he was saying. I'm standing, and this was after one of the new iPhones had come out. The tweet said, I'm standing in front of the Apple store in Shanghai, and there's nobody in line for the new iPhone. We have no idea whether he was in Shanghai, whether he's outside the Apple store, whether he's even telling the truth about nobody standing there. But people are selling the stock based on a tweet. You think that makes no sense? With pricing, it makes complete sense. Pricing is driven by very different forces than drives value. And I'm going to leave you with one final finding from a study that I think is one of the funniest studies I've ever read. What the study actually looked at was football crazy countries, not American football, but soccer crazy countries. And what they looked at is what happens to the stock market in that country after a big national loss. So what they did was they took the World Cup. Basically they went down. And they said, if Brazil loses the World Cup, what happens to the stock market the next day? Let me ask you a question. If you're doing an intrinsic valuation and Brazil loses the World Cup, how much do your cash flows move? Risk didn't change. But they noted that in every soccer crazy country, the day after a really big loss, the stock market dropped about 2 to 3%. So the day after Brazil loses to Germany 7-2, people are going to say, I'm in a rotten mood, sell everything. That's what pricing is. You're not going to be able to explain what happens because it's driven by factors very different. So next session, we're going to dig into pricing. If you don't have the second packet yet, print it and bring it with you because you're very quickly going to get into the second packet. If the tax rates are tied to where you produce and how many people you hire in the U.S.,
yeah.
BMW is in great shape because not only do they produce a lot of stuff in the U.S., they hire a lot of people in the U.S. I think you've got to be careful because there's many a slip between the cup and the lip. Because as you saw, you can make promises to the president, but it's got to get through Congress.
Yeah, right.
So by the time this gets through Congress, many of these things are either going to be taken out or diluted, right? So you've got to be careful about how much of this will actually become part of the new process. I think there is going to be some effect from doing this, but the effect is not going to make BMW go from being a good company to a great company. It's going to be more at the margin, right?
But it's kind of like BMW is so mature and
it is a mature. Don't try to create excitement where there is none, right? And in a sense, the bigger problem for BMW is the electric car business. If you're looking for excitement, that's what you need to look at. Uber and the electric car business are changing the transportation business, right? Changing in what sense? Let's face it, the number of cars we bought reflected the old way that we used to drive, which is each of us had a car. We drove to the parking lot, we parked it all day, we worked all day, the car sat in the park. It's an incredibly inefficient use of a car.
Yeah, and BMW is in the drive now.
But it's going to change the business model, right? They can be in the drive now, but the reality is if I buy one-third less BMWs next year, it's going to be very difficult for them to make up for that with ride-sharing.
revenue. It is true that they're trying to get into ride sharing and electric cars, but on both, they're competing against people who are much better and more established than they are. Ride sharing, they're competing, the Uber's the word, but the electric cars, they're not competing with other car companies, in my view. They're competing with Google and Apple, the electronic companies, right? So it's going to mean that the story has this potentially dark side to it, which is, if it's a great company, it's a great automobile company, but the business itself could very well be on the cusp of shrinkage, right? It's not going to drop off the cliff. People are not going to stop buying cars, but younger people are not buying cars.
Yeah.
In the Bay Area, for instance, a lot of people are used to buy cars because they needed to get somewhere. Yeah. Just use Uber all the time.
Yeah.
So the number of cars sold in the Bay Area has dropped significantly, especially among younger people, and that's going to start spilling around the world, right?
Yeah.
And that's going to, so it's going to be gradual. The revenues for the overall market are going to shrink, which means that the companies will have to compete more in that smaller market. So any story you tell will have to have that overlay of the overall market is probably not going to grow at 3, 4, 5%.
Yeah.
It might be a 0% or minus 1% growth. So when you give me a growth for BMW, yeah, it's got to be within the context of a shrinking market and perhaps even shrinking.
Yeah, markets. I was kind of thinking about looking at the market, like who actually buys a BMW and like a Daimler or an Audi, like.
I think the answer will depend on where you're looking, right? In Germany,
yeah,
the people who buy BMW are more mass, it's more closer to being
exactly
a mass market car. In the US, it's a luxury car because both the pricing and who it's targeted at.
Yeah.
So it's probably going to be very different outside Germany than within Germany. But it'll be interesting to see where
is that too far-fetched?
No, I think what you can look at actually is rather than look at it qualitatively, look at where their how their sales composition has changed over time.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
Because that's going to give you a clue as to who's